Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Movies Under the Influence by Jocelyn Shapaniak-Galise, narrated by Kim Nemi. Introduction. Archives Under the Influence. I took LSD for the first time in Pasadena, Maryland, in the summer of 1996. That wasn't a mistake. My mind really did blow open, and I really did become a different person. No, my screw-up was complacence when my boyfriend and his friends decided to rent a VHS of Natural Born Killers from the local Blockbuster to watch while we came up. By the time Mickey and Mallory were storming through prison, leaving trails of blood and guts in their wake, I was full-on tripping. What I thought was absolute immersion was really a dizzy combination of psychedelic drug and psychoactive movie. Tears streaked my face. I left welts in my boyfriend's arm from digging my nails into his skin. When the movie finally ended, after what felt like 7 ungodly hours, we all walked outside. The halos of the street lamps and the shadows of the trees swirled in rapturous new colors. I still remember the things I saw that night. The dewy nighttime grass spangled like stars, botanical patterns in a stucco ceiling, a heron perched on a barrel in the water that my vision zeroed in on like a zoom lens, and before all that, the hyperviolence on screen. I went to college. That boyfriend and I broke up, and I took acid again, but I never saw the movie a second time. Frankly, I've never cared for Oliver Stone. Was it the drug or the movie? In my memory, the two are inseparable. When we think about movie-going, we tend to think first about what we saw. After that, we might turn to the space of the theater. Maybe next we consider those around us, our friends or unknown fellow travelers. But if you are like me, and I know many listeners are, you may also think about what other extraneous things deadened or heightened your experience. And in some instances, you might recall what substances you swallowed, took, or smoked with the show. Movies are the domain of the optical and the oral. But what we put in our mouths, down our throats, through our lungs, and up our noses dramatically affects how we see what we see. Not only that, substances are commonly sold to us alongside a film, whether it's explicit encouragement of cannabis use for watching Half-Baked, cocktails themed for Guardians of the Galaxy, or even the perilous pleasures of cigarette smoking reflected in a Wong Kar-wai film. For better or for worse, the movies and substances are conspirators of pleasure. In the wake of COVID-19's decimation of the global movie industry, theaters have had to revamp and reconsider their products and delivery systems. For many, that's meant further paeans to the gods of food and beverages. Still, the joys of eating and drinking at the movies, like those documented by Emily Hasty, are fundamentally at odds with masking and theatrical gestures toward safety. It's always wise to be suspicious when a theater claims safety. The theater, after all, is a place of risk, from disease to violence to simply getting fleeced for a small-sized soda. But the drive toward providing more rather than fewer concessions, even when they push against COVID protocols, speaks to how exhibition understands its profit margins. More so, it speaks to the inseparability of substances and cinema. Substances illuminate many hidden truths about how we conjoin film with a larger cultural and historical narrative. For one, they tell us that film doesn't end at the borders of the screen. We're always integrating it into our broader lives. Hence, fears of its ideological overreach, hence the value of representation. The long history of substances and moviegoing, of spectators under the influence, crystallizes that fact. And the fundamental, if hidden, connections between substance use and cinema going speak to discourses of law, manageability, governance, capital, and power. In considering movies viewed under influences, any number of pathways could be followed about the purity of film or experience, about immersion, and about the impact of substance taking on the emotional effects of art. But that's not primarily what this book sets out to do. While intoxicants' effects on spectatorship are one of the stories told here, this book argues that substance use and moviegoing reinforce one another's larger socio-cultural forms. Several characteristics shared by both substance and film experience evidence that bond. First, intoxicant use and public spectatorship are inherently contradictory practices. Both separate individuals from others, either by creating a brain state that can't fully be shared, or by sparking private feelings in an audience that ideally isn't communicating among themselves. Yet both are also forces of sociality. Alcohol, for example, functions as a kind of beneficent glue that brings companions together, however artificially, while moviegoing happens in a crowd of people who, while cordoned off by an agreed-upon etiquette of silence and stillness, are at least marginally interested in the same film. Second, substances and cinema-going are dangerous vices that require regulation by outside forces. State politicians, the federal government, municipal action, temperance organizations, rogue business leaders, narcotics agents, the Walt Disney Company, in order that they might not destroy the order on which the country depends. But third, both are seductive escapist pleasures that sparkle as enticing instruments for the reaches of power. Movies and intoxicants are thereby deeply strange popular objects that together demonstrate how the power of doing, drugs, smoking, drinking, and the power of watching, movies, media extravaganzas, one another, are irresistible for regulation and manipulation, for censorship, and for experiments in control. The very places that free the spectator/user's mind, the movie theater, the drug, are also the very places where power might reach in to wrest control over the spectator/user's mind. Ultimately, the influence of this book's title is proven to be not only the sidelined intoxicant, but also that of American legislative, legal, corporate, and capital power. And so this book is a series of micro-histories of attempts at mediation and social control in the very sites where the American sensorium turns fearfully unmanageable, the movie house and the intoxicant. These micro-histories examine the place of movies in the larger fabric of the American cultural consciousness. By necessity, that means this book takes on the movie's resonance as opposed to specific texts. What it means to be a spectator tells additional parts of the story of what it means to be a lotus eater, and how all of these roles for citizens are in part constructed by profiteers, corporations, the law, and governmental interests. If, as Sadie Plant explains, all drugs have exerted an influence that extends far beyond their users, the same can be said for the movies, which have also enjoyed broad socio-cultural effects that far outsize a specific text's immediacy. American culture has long been and is still under the influences of both intoxicants and film. Spectatorship and the influence. Taking the intoxicated spectator seriously is an uphill battle. They're illogical, they're addicted, they're totally out of it, they're experiencing something that can't be relegated to the experience of film. They're loud, they drop things. They laugh at the wrong times. They talk to themselves and to others. They can't be reasoned with. How could a zonked spectator be anything other than, at best, an annoyance, and at worst, a threat? Movies have long been negatively associated with substances and their shared risk for spectators, especially in that both are addictive scapegoats for social ills. And both substances and movies have long been considered dangers to the well-being of American youth. In 1933, Henry James Forman's Our Movie Made Children gathered supposed evidence from the Pain Fund studies to argue for the terrible effects that film had on children. In a quote attributed to multiple doctors, Foreman explains that if a child shows decreased motility after a movie or sleep loss, this greater quiet may be a quiet of the same type produced by soporific drugs. Similarly, the daydreaming and escapism that are encouraged by repeated filmgoing becomes, in reality, a sort of drug. Along the same lines, showing a frightening film to young people resembles the use of alcoholic beverages. They certainly are not meant for all or even for most children. Even though the Pain Fund studies have long been discounted, such discussions of the dangers of substance use, coupled with the dangers of film, illustrate their lasting unsavoriness and attraction. Today, such fears may no longer come from the addictive properties of film, but contemporary conversations around video games or social media platforms fall back on similar rhetoric. As just two of many examples, Game Quitters offers resources for breaking a video game habit, while physician Brian Boxer Walkler writes of his own addiction to TikTok and subsequent painful withdrawal symptoms. It's beyond the purview of this book to evaluate the truth of these or other statements around media effects. Of course, this is not to say that games or social media or the internet are not addictive. It may well be that one or all of them are. But what is important here is a long trajectory of vocabulary shared between media and substance use. In the public sphere, emotions around all of them run hot. Considering substances tied to spectatorship, then, requires one to wade into some tumultuous and seedy waters. Recently, several scholars take this conundrum head-on. First and foremost, Caitlin Benson Allitt's The Stuff of Spectatorship examines how alcohol and contemporary film exhibition and cannabis and television viewing have walked together of late. Benson Allitt provocatively argues that movie theaters are now places that sell concessions, rather than temples of film. Profit margins have dictated this shift, one only exacerbated by COVID, and many movie theaters, following an Alamo Drafthouse model, have become little more than glorified bars. Selling movies has really meant selling things to consume, from food to memorabilia to alcohol. Benson Allitt's model of cultural, material, and exhibition history, alongside vice discourse, is one this book closely follows. David Church conducts work on psychedelic cinema that considers the value of imbibing psychedelic drugs for film analysis and theory. While not discussing the intoxicated spectator per se, Scott C. Richmond disentangles the cinematic webs of proprioception and other bodily illusions and their effects on the viewer. Janet Steiger explores 2001 and other Head films as indicative of certain exhibition modes, while Vivian Sobchak points to drug use as a potential avenue for phenomenological film theory. Most published work, however, has thought mostly about the spectator themselves and what their theoretical and actual experience means. Movies Under the Influence instead takes on spectatorship via the lens of exhibition from the movie theater's long golden era, the consolidation of the industry in the late 1910s through the very early 1970s. How did exhibition understand the intoxicated spectator? Who did exhibitors imagine that spectator to be? What were the potential dangers, and occasionally benefits, of a spectator under the influence? And how did the specter of vice infiltrate the sanctified temple of the movie house for better or for worse? Before he died, Michel Foucault toyed with the idea of writing a history of modern drug culture. That book would, Sadie Plant argues, have made the perfect complement to his existing portfolio of research on madness, disease, crime, and sexuality. In that spirit, this book owes its most significant debt to Foucauldian discourse analysis. Along similar lines, Mike J.'s Mescaline and his entire peerless body of work on substances is an essential model for micro/macro histories of intoxicants. The works of Martin A. Lee, David T. Courtwright, and Wolfgang Schievelbusch are also of particular inspiration, as are Gerald Horn's Cultural Histories of Hollywood and Labor. But recent laudatory books and articles about the benefits of psychedelic drugs, like Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, are less a part of this book's inspiration. I am not interested in making an argument for or against substance use. That's for each of us to decide on our own. Instead, I'm interested in excavating the ways in which intoxicants have been the movie's dark passenger and how the two figured alongside one another provide insights into fully American approaches to the regulation of vice and the benefits of power in affixing moral panic or potential profit to spectatorship and substance use. As a result, Movies Under the Influence makes a larger claim about the functions of cinematic spectatorship. Namely, that viewing movies cannot ever be separated from the practices of citizenship and the reaches of governance. Movie watching is as inextricably enmeshed, and almost as vexed, in the 20th century American experience as substance use. And in a country as deeply invested, even unconsciously, in both the puritanical and the prurient, movies and substances together point to a desire both to exorcise and exorcise demons of vice. This in turn demonstrates the importance of understanding the conditions of spectatorship, even at their most potentially vulgar, not just for historians and theorists of film, but for chroniclers of American culture writ large. Exhibition Under the Influence, The Archive. At the turn of the 20th century, American film and its attendant industry of exhibition came of age in the midst of tumult associated with urbanization, industrialization, and visual technologies, or as many define it, modernity. Modernity promised massive profits, class mobility, rapid transportation, instantaneous communication, and perceptual wonders, but also bodily dangers from automobiles, factory machines, and devastating instruments of war. According to historians of modernity, all of this translated to a spectator plagued by profound nervous stimulation, from the chaos of the city street to the stunningly innovative visual and temporal representation available on screen. Whether correlating with the surprise of the new, instigating staggering perceptual forms, or simply operating as another aspect of overpowering modern input, film seemed symptomatic of radical shifts rapidly occurring throughout American cities. For Susan Buck Morse, the moment heralded a new approach to the fragmented nervous system and the overwhelmed human sensorium that Walter Benjamin characterizes as shock. At the same time, an abundance of identified nervous disorders led to burgeoning drug prescriptions and use among patients and doctors at the end of the 19th century. Drug addiction, as Buck Morse explains, is characteristic of modernity. It is the correlate and counterpart of shock. Benjamin, as Buck Morse notes, turns to Sigmund Freud's Beyond the Pleasure Principle, 1920, to support and nuance his conception of shock. In an attempt to define the response of the human psyche to shattering events like World War I, Freud proposes the metaphor of a small and simplistic organism, a vesicle of sensitive substance, exposed to the world and therefore to the vastness of stimuli teeming on Earth. But for this organism, vestiges of which we still carry on the surfaces of our bodies as sense organs, protection against stimuli is almost a more important task than reception of stimuli. Sensory inputs' incessant battering against the organism led to a shell-like hardening and a desire to return to a state where nothing pains or bothers any longer. This, for Freud, is thanatos, or the death drive, which exists both in balance and opposition to eros, the sex drive. Ultimately, in addition to Eros urging us toward life, we are subject to the death instinct and a consequent yearning to return to an inanimate form. Substance use, therefore, is deeply rooted in definitions of what the modern subject perceives. It's what we turn to when the pulsing chaos of the city has shredded our nerves to strips, and it's what we seek out when we'd like to just stop thinking and feeling for a while. But what Buck Morse, Benjamin, and Freud make clear is that substance use also has deep affinities with intellectual and artistic experiences, especially those enhanced by technologies. The 18th and 19th century set of optical illusions, magic lanterns, and tricks known as phantasmagoria, Buck Morse says, was a narcotic made out of reality itself. And after the techno-artistic consumer group spectatorial experience of the phantasmagoria, film exhibitions soon followed. Love of the movies is discursively comorbid with love of the substance. Both enchant our experiences of illusion and of reality. Both stimulate us and narcotize us. And both are elevated by the addition of the other. Determining whether perceptual shifts, modernity, and the movies are one and the same, in opposition, causes of one another, or coincidences, is not the point. Instead, it's that the experience of intoxication cannot ever be separated from the other historical discourses that make up how we understand moviegoing. At this point, substances and cinema go together in ways that seem nearly instinctual. A glass of wine at the theater? Eminently civilized. And most people can quickly answer what movies enhance a high, even if they don't personally partake. But history repeatedly reveals that what at first appears natural is, in fact, the product of a tangle of discursive threads. And while intoxicants might seem like a secret force at the movies, or a clandestine pleasure separating us for a brief time from the grip of power, their entwinement with filmgoing has been tightened by ideology, capital, law, civil behavior, and yes, even at the same time, utopian countercultures and dreams of escape. They are both shock and its soothing. They are both regimentation and its collapse. While ideology in the movies tends to be investigated primarily in the text itself, some historians point instead to the place of watching as the primary drama of indoctrination. To be sure, one very valuable way of understanding movies and substances is to look to representation. But that leaves behind how actual spectatorial practice was conceived and regulated by those who, for most of the 20th century, were de facto in charge of audience behavior, exhibitors. A fuller picture of the ways in which exhibitors dealt with substances and spectators, therefore, illuminates how very small facets of power translated, reworked, enacted, or reconsidered larger demands from the government, from Hollywood, from corporations, and from special interests. Scrutiny of exhibitions agonized back and forth over viewers and intoxicants gives particular insight into the microcosm of the movie theater. And the theater is a microcosm of influence, of ideology, of civil society, and of the many stutters, missteps, and on-the-ground negotiations that constitute American democracy. Since movies were first shown in the United States, exhibitors have grappled with what kinds of consumption they should, or should not, allow, encourage, or ban in their theaters. For a teenager in the 1980s sneaking a flask into a midnight horror movie, the very notion of legally buying booze in the theater might have seemed unimaginable. Yet, as scholars such as Ross Melnick, Lee Grievason, and Caitlin Benson-Allett show, saloons and movie theaters were tied together from the very beginning. Alcohol in the theater is hardly a product of the new millennium. Instead, it's a substance, like the others discussed in this book, that has teetered into and out of sight like a drunk person towing a straight line, dependent in large part on the shifting winds of governance. Like alcohol, smoking has a long legacy of association with the theater. But in opposition to alcohol's frequent near erasure from popular memory of 20th century movie theaters, cigarettes have been overly visible, overly present. Other drugs like opium, heroin, and cannabis have a strange presence. While their use was mostly unanticipated or unrecognized in the theater, their specter hung heavy over the industry as panic around dope grew at mid-century. Their invisibility made them all the more dangerous, all the more terrifying. But once psychedelic drugs hit the cultural mainstream, they came closer to acceptable, or at least acknowledgeable. Why have these different substances translated to varying reactions from exhibitors and the public? If all of them are, at root, psychoactive, why have they been subject to such drastically different responses? In what ways have each of them borne burdensome yet generative relationships with filmic experience? And finally, what can the social, economic, and legal images of substances tell us about the twinned constructions of film spectatorship and American citizenship? Historiography, Method, and the Illicit Object. When I first started this project, I knew it would be a research challenge. Documenting the illicit always is. How does one account for what's done in secret? How does one write a history of covert action? By definition, at least as I experienced in the past, watching under the influence is something performed quietly so as not to get kicked out of the theater. Even the widely acceptable consumption of alcohol is a relatively recent phenomenon in American movie theaters. But it was even more challenging than I anticipated. Evidence was never where I thought it should be. The method I anticipated using, historicized analysis of responses to intoxicated spectators in industrial publications, proved insubstantial if not nearly inexistent. This then transformed how I thought about the material and the book itself. Rather than a kind of ethnography of spectatorship under the influence, it became a multi-pronged study of how theaters and the industry operated under and grappled with the multiple potentialities posed by spectators under the influence, whether audiences were actually intoxicated or not. Personal accounts of substance use in theaters held less interest for me than the imagined impact of such usage. Rather than in reminiscences of inebriated behavior, which, let's face it, would be foggy at best, it's in the response of the industry and the law to perceived threats from intoxicated viewers that an ideological picture comes into focus. While such memories might offer proof that spectators took drugs or drank in the theaters, evidence for that already exists. And this history intends to avoid the nostalgic or celebratory nature such recounting tends to embrace. Instead, it examines how substances are both scapegoat and sacrament in much broader sociocultural ways than their immediate psychic effects might suggest. What's lost in retellings of spectators under the influence is gained in what Benson Allett defines as pushing new cinema history toward further ideological analysis. In this sense, this book seeks to perform a dual function: to explore the particular formations of power, political, capital, corporate, civil, cultural, wielded in the movie theater, and the moments when they break apart. The movies and substances are close companions because both are emblems of control and promises of escape. Movies are ideological messaging systems made by enormous corporations a la Stuart Hall, but they are also where we dream of a place outside ourselves or a different way of being in the world. Along the same lines, substances are objects of control over the addicted person or by law enforcement, and repositories of all manner of prejudice and fear. But they are also loci of encounter with the ineffable and the social. There are few places anymore where we encounter the ineffable and the social at the same time. For much of the 20th century, the movie theater was one of those precious sites. Exhibition patterns pose particular challenges for all historians. Much of the material is necessarily ephemeral, given that film screenings were
sample complete. Ready to continue?